Hi, and welcome back to our community, Unsheltered. You know, it always gives me pause when someone who believes themselves to be a practicing Christian blatantly refuses to abide by the second greatest commandment, which is to love thy neighbor as thyself. The Bible is full of exhortations to take care of the poor, the hungry, the homeless, the disabled, etc. I mean, it's mentioned over and over and over again. This expression of God's will doesn't fob those duties off onto a church or other organization. It's a personal directive aimed at each of the followers of Christianity. And yet, rather than abide by the tenets of their faith, the Brookings City Council is looking for ways to shut down the outreach arm of St. Timothy's, which is the only church in the whole community that is actively feeding, clothing, providing showers, and helping the citizens of Brookings Harbor who have fallen on hard times. By the time this episode airs, the City Council will have convened a workshop to look for ways to limit what St. Tim's can do to help these folks. I'm amazed at the audacity of that. If these people were dogs, they would have been sheltered, fed, cleaned up, seen by a doctor, and adopted into loving homes by now. What is wrong with us that we treat stray dogs better than we treat our own fellow human beings? All right, climbing off the soapbox. Joining me tonight is Diana Cooper, the Executive Director of Brookings Core Response, which is an organization that helps find resources for the folks that are struggling here in our community. Diana, welcome to the show again.
Hi.
Yeah. So this latest move on the part of City Council must just feel like a punch in the gut.
Well, I mean, the writing has kind of been on the wall for a little bit that the city wants to move in a direction that's more conservative in the way, and I don't mean that in a political sense, but just more conservative in the way that they approach resources and the way that they approach homelessness. And so, you know, we had heard a couple months ago from, now Mayor Hedenskog, that they had wanted to look at the conditional use permit for St. Timothy's. And then, we didn't hear anything more on it. And I think there was a certain part of us that kind of thought, well, maybe that's the end of it. But there have been a lot of people come forward, community members from around the area of St. Timothy's, and then the city staff themselves that have come forward with some pretty hefty complaints, it sounds like. And, I mean, we kind of thought this was probably coming, but it's definitely not a good time. It's weird because we are recording this beforehand, so we don't know.
I know, we don't know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
But we do, right? I mean, we don't, but we do.
I know. I hate to say, like, well, we already know what they're going to say, because it sort of feels like it pushes out any other option other than what's in our minds. But I think, yeah, I mean, like I said, the writing's on the wall, so we don't expect to go into this and come out with, it's possible we could go into this and come out and have a better relationship with the city, but it doesn't feel that way. It certainly doesn't feel that way from my perspective. I think, I don't want to speak for anybody, but I think that there are people at the church and Father Bernie that are frustrated with this and feeling just sort of questioning. We're trying to figure it all out. You know, we're trying to figure everything out, because some of the allegations thrown out were not really truthful. I mean, they weren't really the reality of what's going on. And so it seems as though not the community, because a lot of people know what we do down there, but it seems as though there are some community members that maybe don't quite understand what we do or know us well enough to talk to us about situations as they come up. So...
Well, that petition that that I saw that was attached to the agenda, I think it had 20 some names on it. something like that from people who live in the area.
Yeah.
But it's so discouraging because those people are not wealthy people, you know? I mean, they're just not, right? They're not wealthy. They're not, you know, they're not millionaires, right? And so who they are turning around and blaming are the people that are just a little bit worse off than they are. You know, it seems crazy.
There, you know, there was a lot of conversation, and I think that this is pretty typical rhetoric that you would hear from any city, any, and I don't mean city like the officials and the council and whatnot, but any community. This is kind of rhetoric that you would hear from them is that, well, you know, it's the if you build it, they will come. And so the idea I think that some people have is that St. Timothy's is anchoring people here who are experiencing homelessness in the sense that we're providing meals and showers and hygiene kits and services and things like that, like connecting them to doctors. And that is what is driving people who are homeless to move here. It's what's, you know, I'm sure that anybody saying that understands that we don't have hundreds of people here who are homeless. But I think the sentiment is that they're any more than what we had before. And that's, you know, it definitely appears from reading the letter and reading some of the other stuff that the sentiment is that St. Timothy's is bringing people here or is attracting people, I guess, is a better word. And that
you know from doing the count that most of the people that are here are citizens of the community. They've been here.
Well,
they're not brand new.
It was about 40% were, you know, born and raised here or lived here when they were younger and grew up here. And another 20% have family here who, you know, they've either been here for generations or they've lived here for a while. And so, you know, we kind of equate that as about 60% of the people are from here or have family from here. Mm-hmm. And then the rest, you know, moved here because of safety issues, or whatever other reasons. Honestly, one man just said, well, I like to fish, so this is the place to be. And he's actually...
But that doesn't have anything to do with St. Tim's, right?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, St. Timothy's has done many programs. In fact, in the agenda, you can see the newspaper articles showing all of the different services St. Timothy's has provided over the years, including that health clinic, which was... Mm-hmm. I mean, the health clinic served way, way more community members than people experiencing housing and even people who are precariously housed. There are a lot of people in our community, especially at that time before the Affordable Care Act was really expanded. There are a lot of people who were working folks, working families who couldn't. In fact, a really good friend of mine, I had talked a little bit about Eugene, but his wife had a medical condition and didn't have insurance because she couldn't afford it. And ended up going to the health clinic, the free health clinic at St. Timothy's. And, you know, they did the checkup, they did all the stuff, and they referred her to a specialist, and she ended up having a tumor removed that was like the size of a football.
Wow.
And probably would have died. So that health clinic served, I mean, hundreds of community members that just couldn't afford insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But even that health clinic, even all the programs St. Timothy's has run, we've never seen numbers like we're seeing now. We've never seen issues like we're seeing now. So that really speaks to something else. It is not St. Timothy's. It is not the programs we're running. It's not the core team. We're not attracting people or keeping people here because we're providing services. There is something larger going on. We've always had homeless here. Before St. Timothy's did meals, we had people who were homeless here. Before they had the health clinic, before we ever formed. But, you know, and I've said this before, we saw such an increase over 2020 and all, you know, even up half of this year is already gone. You know, we've seen such an increase and every community has seen an increase. And so you have to come to the conclusion that we're all coming to. And that is that this is different. That one, we had people who didn't have housing before. We were already strapped, like many areas. And this increase is something else. And to overlook an entire year and a half almost of a pandemic, a global pandemic, regardless of how you feel about the vaccine, regardless of how you feel about the disease itself, let's just talk about the effects of the, you know, the closures and things like that. I think people around here could at least have a little bit of compassion to understand that things closed down. And that innately has a ripple effect. And you know, when services are limited, those at the bottom suffer the biggest shortcoming.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it stands to reason that more people would become homeless because some were already on the verge. So it's definitely
not
us.
And that doesn't even begin to address the fact that the real estate prices just keep going up exponentially.
Right.
So trying to find anything that you can afford to rent in this community is it's virtually impossible.
I mean, our own team struggles to find housing, at our own employees and volunteers, and you know, it affects us personally.
Yeah.
So it affects a lot of the community. Many of, I mean, I can't tell you how many of my friends and peers, and these are people from all walks of life in this community, well, even in other communities, but, you know, my peers over here, they're all, they've all had some sort of issue with housing at one point or another, and some of them recently. So I think it's affected a large portion of the community, but maybe not so much some of the people who are decision makers. Maybe they're not quite understanding the depth of the issue. I'm not sure.
I don't know how that can be. I mean, I think you're being kind. but if they truly don't understand the issue, what that says to me is that they are not talking to their constituents. They are not. They are talking to certain constituents, but they are not talking to the rest of us.
Also, and this I see this in my own personal life. You know, I was born here, raised here, I have a lot of friends still here. And, you know, I have friends on, I'll say, both sides of the political spectrum, even though I recognize there are many more political affiliations than just Democrat or Republic. Right. But I think that there's a certain amount on, you know, it could be on both sides. There's a certain amount of herd mentality that's happening that overrides the ability to see what's going on. And so they're talking to their constituents. But I actually feel that some of their constituents are struggling with these issues too. And so I'm not sure why that's not coming to light. My experience here when I was first becoming homeless was very self-sabotaging. It definitely didn't serve, you know, the way that I acted, the way that I talked did not serve my own best interests. It was groupthink mentality of a sort. Because of the area that we live in and, you know, because this is all I knew. And so a lot of how I felt about myself was that, you know, we talked about this before, that I just need to pull myself up by my bootstraps and trying to figure out how to do that and not being able to, because clearly that's not the way to do it.
No.
And then just being like, well, there is something inherently wrong with me.
Right. Right.
And
you sure wouldn't want to admit that. I mean, if one of your friends was sitting on city council, you would not want to admit to that friend that you considered yourself to be basically worthless because you were having problems.
And I don't want to, like, you know, put too much conjecture on what the Republican constituents for our council members think or feel or their experiences. But from my own experience, having been, because I definitely wasn't a Democrat growing up, I don't think we were Republican, but I would say we probably leaned on that side more. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that my parents were political at all, actually, really. They had opinions about things, but that was about it. Right. So, you know, I do understand some of that, even though I, again, don't want to put conjecture out there on what those constituents feel like. I can say my own experience with it and see some of the similarities in what I'm hearing from other community members. So, you know,
it's just kind of discouraging to me, you know, you know, before we lost Jake as our mayor, I actually had a little bit of hope that, that maybe there would be some changing of hearts and minds because Jake could at least see the other side. You know, he could at least see the other side. And
I think because he continuously put himself out there in a way that it left no room for, you know, it was very transparent and it left very little room for swaying of his mind behind closed doors.
And if you actually look at all of the people in your community as your citizens, I mean, if that's the way you hold them, is that they belong to us.
And there's a pride in that, yeah.
Right? Then they belong to us. And you don't turn your back, you know, just because somebody's had a hard time. I mean.
No. And truly, I mean, so at the very beginning, you know, I've spoken about this before as well, but the very beginning of the pandemic, you know, when I kind of set out and settled in with St. Timothy's and started trying to figure out trying to look at some of the options and around our area. You know, the first thing I did, obviously, was went to the city. Well, I spoke with Jake and it was kind of like, you know, what is the city going to do? And they ended up passing the car camping allowance for the churches. And so I was like, okay, that's the direction that the city's taking. So, it sounds like the churches will need to step up. And so sitting down with the churches and talking with them and kind of being redirected to like, well, the city should be dealing with this, and then going back to the city and then having them say like, well, you know, we put it on the churches. Like, so this is sort of how it is. This is the option that there is. And having that go nowhere on nobody willing to take up the torch for that. And you know, I definitely thought that the city should have had more responsibility in there. As much as I pushed the churches, or at least tried to in our brief meetings with any of the pastors. But, you know, it's hard to say like where that buck should land and where that mm-hmm. last stop is. But mm-hmm. I certainly feel that the city could have done more. And I mean, when a lot of the argument on why the churches didn't want the car camping on their property was because, you know, they didn't want people that weren't part of their congregation, or they were concerned about crime, or they were concerned about neighbors and police and complaints. But actually having, and that's not a good system, having it spread around to all the churches is not the best system. But having it, you know, if that had happened and we say we'd had 5 churches doing it, it would have spread out, kind of spread the burden out just a little bit, and would have been a little bit easier to mitigate some of the issues because there's another place to go. And the reason why the core team is working so diligently on finding offsite and why St. Timothy's supports us in that is not to like divert the attention away from St. Timothy's, but it's to shoulder some of the burden, the physical location of that burden, because people there, and I mean, we just sat down with a gentleman yesterday who, you know, he's a very put together guy. I mean, just had one mishap happen and it snowballed from there. But working on getting his business license, working on getting all his stuff legal and set, he just got into housing. And he's talking to us he's struggling because there are people there at St. Timothy's who have some serious mental health concerns. So it's not really a haven for everybody. You know, people go and they have to be around people who are constantly triggering them, even when they're in a good place like he is. Mm-hmm. You know, he's in a good mental space, but he still gets triggered. Mm-hmm. And I'd say he has probably some of the highest tolerance out of anybody there. So having that conversation with him, I mean, there's nothing we can do about that right now. There's no other space for people to be. We're trying. You know, honestly, Project Turnkey was an effort sort of to help mitigate some of this pressure that St. Timothy's has. They don't want, you know, the vestry, Father Bernie, the advocacy team, they don't want to be the only ones there because of this, because of things like this. You know, we get told a lot, like, your people, they're not, you know, they're not my people. They're people. They're just community members. And we don't tell them, we can't tell them what to do or where to go. So we just try to help them the best we can. And sometimes that takes a long time. So we need to have a stable place for them to be while we're providing services. And right now, St. Timothy's is it. Right. And if we lose that, I mean, our team already spends, 15 hours a week on foot or outreach. So, or roughly around that, because we only get 9 hours a week at St. Timothy's. So the team is most of the time doesn't have a site, and we're just sort of trying to case manage people on the street. And that can get really difficult. It's great to have a site so that even a couple days a week, people know where we're at. They can come in. Maybe that's their first contact with us so that we can get some info before we kind of have to chase them around a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, losing St. Timothy's would be, I don't think it'll come to that. I really don't. But I don't know what's going to happen on Monday night. And obviously we're all praying and we're all hoping that the council will understand what's going on and help us, you know, come together and help us navigate this instead of coming against us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not holding my breath. I don't know about you. I just am not encouraged.
A little.
I'm not encouraged by the attitudes that I'm seeing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm it's not for our mayor, our current mayor, to say that the homeless want to be homeless is I
right.
Don't know what to do with that. You know,
it's so far beyond the truth that,
yeah.
It's not hard to explain, but I have already explained it. And so, you know, it's funny because one of the things that Matt says often is that I can explain things in a way, I won't say it all on here because he's kind of cheeky about it, but he says basically that I explain things in a way that someone of his intelligence level can understand, and he likes that. And so I don't know why he says that, because I think he's incredibly intelligent. But
right.
What he means by that is that he thinks that I have a really good way of explaining things and breaking things down and mm-hmm. making them real. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how many times I can explain that if there are three people and two houses, that one person isn't choosing to not have a house.
That's right.
There is no house to choose. So even if you built a house and that person chose it, okay, now you can say they're not. Now right. You can. But until right. that day happens, no, you cannot say they are choosing it. And even if you built that house, if you told them, I think a lot of smokers would relate to this. You can't smoke in this house. They're either going to smoke in the house anyway, or they're not going to take it.
Right.
So it depends, too.
Or if you tell them, here's a house, but you have to pay everything that you have to live
right.
here. Every single penny that you have to live here, and right. more. Then you can't.
Yeah, it's...
It's so... It defies common sense, as far as I'm concerned.
And I'm not, I mean, you know, Matt and I have done that. We've all, I think, all of us that have struggled with either, whether it's with homelessness or you know, low wages or whatever the case may be, when maybe we just had trauma. We've all done that. We've all had to pay everything we had. We've all lived paycheck to paycheck, and some still mm-hmm. do. Mm-hmm. But to say that that's what you deserve if you want housing is ludicrous. I mean, it just is. That's absolutely absurd, because there are people who can spend $10,000 in a day and not be bothered at all. And that could change my life.
Yeah.
Oh, you know,
yeah.
So
it would change my life.
So to say that this is what you deserve to be in housing, well, then everybody should have to have that to be in housing. I don't know. That's probably a very liberal way of thinking. I'm not sure. Now that it came out of my mouth.
But I think that, you know, you either have the idea that people are basically good and are basically trying to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have the opposite idea that people are basically bad, trying to be bad. They're going right. to take advantage of you whenever they can.
Or there's a third, which is these people are basically good and these people are basically bad. And that's where I see a lot of the stereotyping, not just around homelessness. It could be around anything, but certainly, obviously, that's where I'm at. But that's where I see a lot of stereotyping, because some of the most similar behaviors in the people that I'm working with and the people that are coming out against them, some of the behaviors are so similar
mm-hmm.
that to not be able to draw those parallels makes me kind of crazy inside.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I talked, well, I posted on Facebook that we had lost someone in our community. And I'll talk about that a little bit. But, you know, when I posted that, a lot of what I really wanted to convey and what I really hope to convey all the time is that I think I mentioned something about, you know, when you see people and they don't have housing and you get upset with a certain behavior that they have, and, you know, your inclination is to tell them to stop or call the police or something like that, to just stop for a second and recognize that this is not a homeless person having behaviors. This is a person having behaviors. And all people have behaviors. And I recognize that there are some behaviors that are harmful, but most of them are just what we would call, you know, obnoxious, or, you know, when somebody's cussing. I think that the stereotype we hear about most often is this dirty person who's homeless, who's cussing and, you know, smells like alcohol or is strung out, and just all of these. I mean, that literally could be anybody. It doesn't matter what their housing status is. That could be anyone. And so I really want to put the focus more, and the reason why we changed our name, on that it's not homeless people, it's just community members, and some of them don't have housing, and some of those people who don't have housing have behaviors just like people who do. I wish there was a way to get people to take the veil of homelessness off and just understand these are just people.
But I wonder, you know, I hear you loud and clear, but I wonder if the reason they keep the veil in place is because it's more comfortable. It's more comfortable to lump them all together, and you know, then they can feel righteous about saying, yeah, not in
but
my
backyard.
But it's
not more comfortable. I mean, they're literally over there signing petitions against yeah. St. Timothy's, and the petition is to remove homeless from St. Timothy's, which, by the way, is a weird petition.
Right?
because I don't know.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
I can't even think of something comparable, because it's just kind of weird. But
well, if you interchange that with race or right. creed or
right.
gender, I mean, if you interchange that with any of the other kind of categories, you'd be appalled, right?
Right.
No more black people at St. Timothy's. Run the black
right, could you
people
imagine?
Out, right?
A petition to remove.
Run the women out
yeah,
of St. Timothy's.
Yeah, a petition to remove women from St. Timothy's, which,
right?
by the way, would be like everybody there.
I know, right,
well,
right.
all the staff and volunteers. Just be but, Bernie sitting there by himself.
But even if it was like, remove all the men. I mean, we would never sit still for that.
Right,
We'd
yeah.
never sit still for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but we're seriously considering this. It's weird.
Oh, really seriously considering it? I mean, you know, it's possible that the city council has not made up their mind. It is possible. But I
yeah.
doubt it.
There's yeah. a better way to deal with this. And, you know, I think that on a community level, that's really where we look to leadership, is to help set the tone for the community mm-hmm. as well. And that is why, you know, you were talking earlier about sort of having hope when Jake was in office. And I sent him an email right before, right after the council meeting, not the last council meeting he had, but the one before where we actually talked about Project Turnkey. Mm-hmm. And I had sent an email basically saying that, you know, when he talked about, I want to see the city shift before the end of my term, which we didn't know was going to be so soon.
No.
Before the end of my term, I want to see the city move in a direction that addresses this. And I sent him an email after and just basically said that that alone gave me a lot of hope. You know, I don't necessarily think that I had hope the entire council was going to feel the same way, but it set a tone.
Yes, it did.
And that's sort of one of the jobs of leadership, is to set the tone for the community or the you know, town, county, whatever. And I mean, the president sets a tone for the United States.
Yep. Yep.
I think people receive that differently, and that's fine. We all are entitled to that, but it helps the people who are in between, who are trying to figure out where the moral line is. And so it just feels as though with that gone, that our moral line is in a different place.
Yep.
Than it should
be. I agree.
I mean, we were lucky to even get that little bit of hope that the moral line might shift.
And
so.
And when you think about how that felt, mm-hmm. That hope, that thought that there was a moral line that actually meant something, mm-hmm. you know, that spoke to those of us who, I don't know, really do believe that we are our brother's keepers. The way that felt was so good that the contrast of how it feels now is like really demoralizing, you know, really yeah. demoralizing.
Well, I mean, that next meeting was obviously a lot different of
yes.
a tone, and
yes.
I,
yeah.
you know, it's not funny, but it's, we didn't laugh, we'd cry.
No, we, and we did cry.
And I mean, we cried.
You know, that is the truth. And
yeah.
it was nice to feel that if even for a moment, you
well,
know.
Well, it's also a little bit empowering in the long run too, because it's like, hey, they don't have to keep going this direction. And
that's
we
right.
knew that. We knew
yes.
that.
Yes.
I, you know, I think I've stated this before, but one of the things that 2020 has given us is the ability to see how fast political will can change when it has to. And unfortunately, the last part, when it has to, is really more the caveat, because it means that we have little, you know, we, the little we's, we have a little less say in that political change than we thought. But something like a natural disaster clearly changes political will very quickly, like the fires, the pandemic, just sort of everything. But, you know, the protests really showed how political will can change under human
yes.
pressure.
Yes. And it didn't take that long.
No, it didn't.
I mean, when you look at it, it didn't take that long. I mean, it took longer, obviously, than a pandemic
mm-hmm.
that shut everything down.
Well, it didn't take that long because 2020, white people finally were like, oh,
yeah,
I might need to do something. And so
yeah.
that's why. I mean, it's so blatantly obvious that people in a position of power, especially white men, can influence things. I mean, I'm not even saying city council members. I'm saying if I don't know how this sounds, but if you're a white male in this community and you think that what's going on with St. Timothy's is absurd, your voice probably will carry more weight than mine.
Absolutely.
And it will certainly carry more weight than any of the people we serve.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So if you got up and spoke, you know, I mean, that's probably more than I can do. So,
and frankly, if you were a Republican white male,
right.
who found what the council is trying to do to St. Timothy's to be repugnant, right? And
yeah.
you actually stood up and said that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that would make a huge difference. Huge.
And we can say it's unfortunate, but it's just the reality right now. So we just need to do that. Yep. You know, that's why all of us who are, you know, have made the commitment to be allies to Black people or to people of color and put ourselves in that position. Like we have that responsibility now, and it's really important that we not stop ourselves from doing. It's important that we not hesitate to do that. I mean, stop and think, sure, but you know. So
But always look for what the righteous position is. For what the right position is. Always look for that and always align yourself with that. Because otherwise, I don't know, otherwise you're just wasting time. Just wasting time, wasting energy. I mean, there are people who are dying. There are people who are dying.
And it's very fulfilling to be able to influence people in a positive direction. And so something like that can actually, I mean, really can give purpose to even if it's just standing up for, you know, whether it's a protected class or just a group of people that are needing it, standing up and helping divert that energy and helping make that change really can give you a sense of purpose. And so, you know, it's not unrewarding.
No, by no means. I mean,
And you see real change happen. So
tell us about the man who died, if you can.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I won't say his name just out of respect for any friends or family that maybe don't know yet, but I suspect that they all do. So this is a gentleman who has been coming around for a while. Probably a couple of years, but hasn't really engaged with anyone until recently. In fact, I started doing, so in December, the city council passed a ordinance that meant you can't live in your vehicle in city limits. And we also had a lot of issues with the can and bottle returns being shut down due to, you know, COVID and whatnot. And so it was just really poor timing. I mean, there's never good timing for that. And I don't think that should even be a law, but it was really poor timing because now we have people who can't even get $5 in gas through cans who can't stick around to town. But if they go out, I mean, I can't tell you how many times that one of us will go bring gas to someone who's stuck a couple miles up because they couldn't sleep in town. So they travel out of town. And when that happened, a bunch of people started going about a mile or so up just to get out of town. And so all of those people who had already been staying a little bit out of town had to go even farther. So it was just this weird sort of chain reaction. But, you know, we wrote a grant, the coalition gave us funding, and then another foundation gave us funding to help provide fuel. And so I started doing a fuel program where they can get gas once a week, $10 in gas, and most people choose to do it on Fridays. And it's, you know, it's not going to get them far, but it's enough to supplement so they can stay out of town for the weekend or something. And this particular gentleman hadn't really engaged with us much before until I started doing that. And then he started coming and getting gas every week. And I mean, I just saw him on Wednesday and, you know, he was having some health issues and then he felt like they were kind of getting worse. And so we were, you know, he wanted us to help him at that point. And so we stepped in and we were helping him get a doctor. In fact, we just sent off his new patient paperwork, I think probably at the end of last week, waiting for a doctor's appointment. And, you know, I went and saw him Wednesday, gave him gas. We talked. He's an older guy. You know, he was in his 50s and pretty rough dude, but really funny guy, just like really funny. So, you know, I went and gave him gas and we sat and talked for a while. And, you know, then Friday, I think it probably happened on Thursday or possibly Friday morning, but I think Thursday. And then Pat came in and let us know, you know, the gentleman that he'd been living in his van with another man in town. And so that man had called us and told us. But, you know, it's really hard because there's been so many in the last, you know, since September that this makes 10 people that, you know, we know were without housing. We didn't work with all 10. There was a couple people we didn't really work with, but we knew them. And so, but him, we did. We worked with him. And I don't know. I felt like we were just sort of coming. He was just sort of coming around and we were going to be able to get him into a doctor. And I don't, you know, none of us knew it was that serious. I don't think he knew it was that serious. But yeah, it just feels strange to see someone one day and then them just not be there, you know. And that's how it's been for a couple of people where we're working with them. You know, one gentleman, the one that got hit by the truck downtown, you know, it was the day before I was talking to him. I'm like, okay, well, we're going to meet up tomorrow and we're going to get this. You know, we had some paperwork that was overdue and I was actually like kind of frustrated. And I was like, you know, I don't know why you were out of town so long and we got to get this in. And then the next day he was just gone. So it's, I know I'm not the only one that thinks this. I'm sure, you know, it probably runs through Michelle's mind and maybe Bernie, I don't know. But I always think, what did I miss? You know, what could I have done? I imagine doctors think that too when, you know, a patient dies. Maybe, I would assume. But
what difference do you think it would have made in those lives if they had had a place to live?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk about this a lot at St. Timothy's because it's so hard to quantify it's hard to quantify what would be different. But we know we can quantify it. We can qualify it as well, but it's hard to put that out to somebody and say A, B, and C, you know, like,
well, they would have had a bathroom. First of all.
Right. So a lot of the people that we work with and some of the people that have passed away were unable to access restrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Probably all of them, but a couple of them that had medical conditions. And we have people now, you know, still living, people that we work with that we're going to see on Monday who are living in vehicles. That's a big one. When you're living in a vehicle, you tend to get swelling. We see a lot of swelling in the ankles and the feet and the legs.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of edema. Probably for more than half the people we work with that live in their vehicles, there's some sort of edema or skin issue going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't take medications like Lasix or other congestive heart failure medications because it makes them have to use the restroom. And they'll tell us, I'm not taking that because I don't want to pee myself.
Mm-hmm.
So even sometimes we buy Depends for people because that's, you know, because they either have to take it or they just need that.
Right.
So people are going without a lot of medications that they need. They're going without a lot of treatments that they need. As far as the people that passed away, you know, like I said, we can qualify that. And, you know, we know. One person in particular, he wouldn't have been out when at that time. He would not have been roaming around at that time if he had had a bed.
Yep.
You know, if he had housing.
Yep.
A couple of them, they would not have been out doing that. And there's no way.
Housing also means that you have a kitchen, which means that you can actually prepare food.
And it also means that you can have a caregiver if you're disabled and and you need that.
Yes.
So, I mean, in the absence of that, people tend to not take care of themselves because they can't do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there is a lot that having housing, you know, can help as far as medical conditions. With this particular gentleman, you know, he would have been able to take the medication that he was supposed to take. He wouldn't be sleeping in a van. He was sleeping sitting up most of the time. And he didn't.
So he had to have been cold when it was cold out. He had to have been damp when it was raining.
I mean,
there's all of those things that play into, you know, how you're doing.
I think a lot of it, most of it, is that sometimes people just need rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're sick or when you're stressed, you know, or you're depressed or whatever the case may be. Sometimes people just need rest. I mean, we all literally just need rest sometimes. And so, you know, not allowing people to have a place, even if they only have a tent, maybe that's all they have. Mm-hmm. Not allowing them to have a place to set up their tent takes away their dignity, but it also takes away some of their, some behaviors that can contribute to their health, including sleeping.
Right.
So, and I realize that there's, you know, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. or something like that, but sometimes people need more sleep than that. There's just various reasons.
If you're taking a nap under a tree in Azalea Park and you get rousted because you're taking a nap under a tree, but only, right. of course, if you're homeless, you know, if
right.
if I were taking a nap under a tree in Azalea Park, I bet I wouldn't get rousted. I bet
we,
I wouldn't.
We go often, actually. Mm-hmm. our team goes often and has a nap in the park. And it's actually a really, I mean, honestly, it's kind of therapeutic. We go out into the park and we sit and we usually discuss things. And sometimes we just really just lay our head down and we just rest mm-hmm. for a while. And it's not a test, like we're out there sleeping to see if the police roused us. But it's part of us exercising our rights, but we also understand our privilege in that, that we'll probably right. never get messed with.
Right.
But it's really interesting. And sometimes we have people come out that we're working with and they come out and they join us and lay around with us. And we, there's actually been some great discussion happening at those little, we call them staff meetings.
That's great.
And
that's great.
You know, it's, I think for us, especially, you know, for Michelle and I, being so frustrated with the fact that people can't just lay down and rest when they need to sort of compelled us to kind of want to go, I don't know, make a point, make a stand, do something that, you know, so we go out there and we do that. We haven't done it in a while, but you know, we usually tell everybody we're heading out there and whatnot. And like I said, it's just a great communication time, if nothing else. We all sit around and talk, and sometimes they give their input and, you know, ask questions and whatnot. So we have a little power.
See, I think that's part of the whole issue, you know, is that they are people. They are people mm-hmm. just like you and me, just like us, with
yeah.
a couple of circumstances that are different.
Right.
Just because of luck, mostly.
Well,
right?
I mean, it's just a different set of circumstances because we have people who are, you know, it's like, so I mentioned this on my post, it's like cancer. You know, there are people who are without housing. There are people who have housing. There are people who are, you know, have millions of dollars that get cancer. All kind doctors, all different mm-hmm. kinds of people get cancer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's just one group area, you know, you can say all the people that have cancer.
Right.
But know that that's only one thing about them.
Right.
And you know that if you took five of those people who had cancer and put them all next to each other, they could be, it could be anything, could be any different variety of people and makeup of people and all of
and
that.
Would you actually go so far as to say anybody who has had cancer is not allowed to take a nap in the park.
Right.
I mean, right? I mean,
right.
Like really? Really? So you're going to discriminate on the basis of choose
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I mean, it's really
just choose one, right? Yeah.
It's just a part of, you know, when we talk about addiction, drug use is only one part of addiction. It really is. You know, my biggest addiction, believe it or not, was not drug use. And I've done a lot of work on mine. I actually, well, by the time this airs, I'll have 8 years clean and sober because I have 8 years on the 11th.
Good
I think
for
that's
you.
When this, you know, I think yep. by the time this airs. So, I forgot what I was saying. Get
okay,
distracted by my clean date.
Addiction. It was about addiction. Oh, addiction isn't just about drug use. That's,
yeah,
that's where
yeah.
you went. Yeah,
thank you
yeah.
for keeping me on track.
No problem.
yeah, so it's not. It's really, you know, it's really all of these different pieces of it that make up addiction. And so is homelessness. And so is illness. And so is anything. I mean, is wealth. There's so many different things that make up wealth. And so it's weird to take, this word homeless and decide that here are the parameters that everybody in this bubble that is called homelessness is allowed to do this and isn't allowed to do this. And I realize that that rule is for the general public, but the discretion is not so much discretion. It's a little bit more discrimination in the enforcement of that. And that's not my opinion. This is what we're seeing. So, you know, if a teenage kid broke something in the park, I mean, they may not pursue charges. They may just drop it. I think that if there was some issues going on with somebody in the park, they would probably not 86 that person from the park if they were someone in the community that had housing, because they would just assume like, well, that person can just go cool off in their housing.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. since that's the only place someone who doesn't have housing might be able to sit and stay and hang out, they would have more incentive, obviously, to 86 them to ensure that they're not there for a little while. And I mean, to be totally honest, we've been present when someone was kicked out of the park just for being homeless. Michelle was there and confronted all of the staff, and they admitted, the staff member admitted, well, you know, I thought he was kicked out, and he was not. And so when they verified that, it was kind of like a ho-hum, you know, well,
mm-hmm.
you win some, you lose some. But to that man, that's everything.
Yeah. And you know, right? I mean, a simple apology would have been nice.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry about thinking you were, you know, a piece of trash that should be kicked out, you know.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating to me. You know, I keep coming back to the way this community treats stray dogs,
mm-hmm.
treats stray animals. We love them. We bring them into the shelter. We make sure that they're cleaned up. We make sure that mm-hmm. they're bathed, that they've got a doctor looks at them, and we get them adopted as quickly as possible into a loving home.
And if they're experiencing aggression or behaviors, we treat that.
Yes.
We get them help for that.
Yes.
And we understand that.
Yes.
We get it. We get that the trauma that they were dealt
yes.
caused it.
Yes.
And so that's the only way to stop it.
Yes.
But
they're not choosing to be bad dogs.
Right. And that
because
that
they want to be a bad dog. Yeah, I know.
That thinking doesn't translate to humans because there is the option of choice. And that's not really relevant in a lot of the arguments that it's entered into, because again, you know, the scenario with two houses and three people, there has to be a choice first. And,
right.
you know, I, it's easier to look at a man who's dirty and on the street and yelling and saying that he's choosing to have that aggressive behavior, than it is to see a dog who's, you know, whatever, growling and defensive, and say that they're choosing it because they're a dog. You know, how could they choose it? But in the same primitive sense, we have a primitive brain. You know,
yes.
we have
exactly
this one. What is it? 1 inch long piece of the brain called the amygdala that controls all of our fight or flight, and it pulls all of our blood in and gets it ready for us to run and do all that. We don't choose to do that. That
no,
just
exactly.
happens. That is
exactly.
a scientific, natural phenomenon.
Exactly. And if you've been raised under certain circumstances and, you know, have, you know, certain things that you grew up with and people that
right.
you grew up, I mean, it's all, you know.
And there's something called epigenetics, which is the handing down of trauma generationally. And that's also a scientific, that's a proven fact. That's not something that social workers came up with to blow off behavior. There's this, when you're under stress for your entire life, it can change. It doesn't change the biology of your genes. It doesn't change the makeup of them, but it can turn on and off those little expression switches. And so I was telling my kids about this. I know we're getting close to time. I was telling my kids about this the other day about how, when a woman is born, she has all the eggs she's going to have for her entire life already. So when she's in her mother, whatever her mother does directly affects that mother's grandchildren. Right. I mean, just immediately affects them, whether if she's drinking, if she's smoking, if she's eating high fat foods, all of this is going to affect directly because it affects the switch in there. Right. And so generation after generation, now we have people who have hypertension and cardiovascular disease and things like that, that we didn't have these high amounts of before. Or maybe we did and we just didn't have ways to test it. But I think that the trauma hands down generation to generation, and that's not something we can go back and fix, but we can certainly try to get more to the root of it than just dealing with a person having behaviors and thinking that they are choosing that and they're obnoxious. I have a son who has PTSD, and when he's in fight or flight, he's not choosing that.
No, exactly.
It's very hard to see as a parent. And he requires medication to treat that. So, like a lot of people.
I have a grandson as well. So, I know. So, I'm seeing the little green sign that basically tells us that we're out of time.
So fast.
I know. It always goes fast.
Every time.
I know. So another really great conversation, Diana. I thank you for your willingness to keep coming and, keep saying it over and over and over again. And, I keep hoping that somebody new will get the message each time, right? Somebody new will be able to hear it.
It's like Saturday morning, and I'll be like, oh, what are we going to talk about even today? And then there's always something. Everybody's going to hear this late, so we'll already know by the time this airs what's going on at council. Yep. That'll be weird.
It will be weird
to hear our conjecture.
And I want to thank you for listening. We need to rethink the message that we're sending to our community members who've fallen on hard times. Right now, the contrast between how we treat stray dogs and how we treat those people doesn't speak very well of us as a community. How foolish it would be of us to take in a stray dog, feed it, bathe it, and then put it back out on the street. We all need a home, a place that we can call our own and not get rousted by the cops for taking a nap under a tree. We shouldn't forget, most of us are one significant disaster away from being on the streets ourselves. Lend a hand or a shoulder if you possibly can. This is Candace Michelle for Our Community. See you next time.